And that was not what the Jews were hoping for. When Jesus did this, they put him on a cross. When Paul did it, they put him in chains. I am in chains for the hope of Israel.
Is it possible that this view of this conviction state allows them to be, or kind of put them on shaky grounds with their salvation, because it might be even some anti-Christ, since they don't believe the first coming of Christ was adequate?
I don't know, sir. I hope not. I don't feel called upon to pass judgment on them. I think they're saying, now, many preachers take the view that it's harmless. Now, I would not make the test of fellowship. I do not make the test of fellowship. The fact that the person is dispensational, that fact in and of itself does not mean not my brother. But I do not, that does not mean I don't consider it very dangerous, because I think the implications of it are very significant. We'll see this as we proceed. Now, because, in my opinion, to hold to dispensationalism, you have to deny the New Testament teaching on the kingdom based on the Messiah. You said it doesn't mean that. Did Jesus? Well, anyway, you get the, so it gives us the general trend. I use this to introduce where we're going here. So if the Jews were wrong about the hope of Israel, what led them to this error? Well, we know what led them to the error. They viewed it in a hyper-literal way. What they did exactly what the dispensationalists do. They viewed as super-literal the promises of earthly glory, of the kingdom, of David's throne. And when it came to the part about the suffering, the dying, the humility, then they allegorized that, which is the basic hermeneutic of dispensationalism, as they admit. And you see, these sections we're going to look at now, that the throne of David prophecies, for instance. Why do you think it was that Peter, one of the first prophecies he cites is the throne of David prophecy in Acts chapter 2? And he says, we're going to see this later, he talks about the resurrection, the ascension, and the present, and now, and this is it. Here we are, we've got it. And he said, oh no. Throne means throne, and kingdom means kingdom, literal or nothing. So Paul's in chains. But you see that the general theme, the hope of Israel? They hope for it. What led them to it? What was the hermeneutic undergirding this hope? Whatever it was, they were sure wrong about it. So where Paul is saying, I am in chains not because I've done anything wrong, but because what I offered to Israel in the name of the prophets was not what they were looking for. And you see, let me suggest this, that dispensationalism, this is just an opinion, what I've observed, and my observation is very limited, maybe it's not working. But dispensationalism often takes root among the very kind of people that glommed on to the charismatic movement. It offers compensation. One of the themes that occurs in dispensationalism, or it subtly lurks there between the lines, is that we're looking for, you know, we hate evil, we hate sin. We're looking forward to the day when our Messiah comes, when we can get our licks in. I mean, we have been able to close down the topless filling jet before our Messiah comes. We're going to get you guys. It's sort of and it's never explicit. Sometimes it is. It's always implicit. And that is, we're going to help God judge. He comes back, we're going to be the master, we're going to be in charge, and then it's our turn. Everybody look out. We're going to get you. Which is very unbiblical, by the way. Business belongs to God. And I'll tell you, if we keep our spiritual lives straight, that'll be enough. I think we ought to let God take care of doing our business in the world. And our concern is Douglas. Let me say this. The mentality is often strong in the Jews. You see, Paul teaches Romans, it was the Jews were chosen not to rule the world, but to save them, to minister to them. And we are not, we are the chosen of God now. We're the peculiar people. We're the chosen generation, right? Look at the sinners, the ones who create disgust in us, the notable sinners. It is, our attitude toward them is not, boy, you wait till Jesus comes back, and then the club will be in our hand. Our concern is that we are to love them and to do everything we can to save them. We are here to save them, not to punish them. This position is, it's my opinion, sort of leans toward that mentality. Compensates for present inadequacy and being present. What do you think that word for us is? So we have that associated as well. The hope of Israel was based upon the promises, the prophecies that we're going to study in this section. This is foundational, it's fundamental. First of all, the land promised to the patriarchs. The land promised to the patriarchs. You hear much today about the, you're many today who promote the idea that the modern state of Israel has a theological right to exist. That is, that God promised this land to Abraham, and that that promise is only now in the process of being kept. It was not kept before. Now, Lindsay teaches this, by the way, that God promised the land to Abraham and his descendants forever, and that that promise has not been kept. Now, first of all, well, what does the Bible say? By the way, this is a very critical question. You often hear a preacher say, well, Israel will never be driven out because God has promised that land to them, that those who try to drive out Israel are fighting God. They're not going to thank God, but it'll be bad if the Arabs do drive, exterminate the Israelites, or diminish their borders. So that's what they're trying to do. The Arabs, they're not wanting to eradicate the city of Israel, they're wanting to reclaim the West Bank. And if they do it, well, what will happen? Now, first of all, let's look at the nature of the... So the nature of the question is, as I'm saying here, either God has fulfilled this promise or he has not. The land promised to the patriarchs. Let's look at the promises themselves and the boundaries of the promised land. Exodus 23, verses 30 and 31, I give you here on your outline. God promised to Moses the gradual elimination of the Canaanite tribes. Uh, Exodus 23 says, by little and little I will drive them out before you until you be increased and inherit the land. And I will set thy bonds from the Red Sea even unto the Sea of the Philistines, and from the desert unto the river. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and thou shalt drive them out before thee. Now, in Numbers 34:5, we have the boundaries also stated. And your border, in detail, it says, and the border shall turn direction from Asmon to the brook of Egypt, or river of Egypt, and its termination shall be at the sea. I didn't bring my copy of Lindsay with me this morning. Like we've seen carrying it too much. But, by the way, understand what's going on here. That if the Bible teaches that the land promises made to the patriarchs have been kept, this all but destroys dispensationalism, really, because that is, it's like a three-legged stool has lost a leg. There's a little bit left, but it won't stand. It's absolutely critical. Now, the promise made to, what were the boundaries that we're looking at now? The boundaries of the promised land. Now, this one doesn't have good maps in it. No maps at all. Get on where we are. The boundaries stated that Israel would have would be from the river to the north-south boundaries, or the east-west, depending on how you're looking at it. This is west, not east, but you know what I'm saying. Exodus, in the one that I read in Exodus 34, it gives the boundaries as the river or brook of Egypt. And the river. Now you realize that, those who hold that the promises have not been kept. The promises made to the patriarchs of the land of Canaan, this land. One of the major arguments, if not the major argument, is that Israel never occupied the borders promised, that Israel never owned all that land, never controlled it. And here's what they say. Here's the position. I'll take time to read it to you, but read it for yourself, take my word for it. It says from the river. And what river, in the Old Testament, it says the river. What does it mean? The Euphrates, the common term. Now, no question about that. The Euphrates River up here. Now, however, the other question is, what is the river of Egypt? Well, it says the Nile. The Nile is the river of Egypt, and Israel has never controlled the land from the Euphrates to the Nile. Get that? And because Israel has never controlled the land from the Euphrates to the Nile, therefore the promise has not been kept. The problem with that is, the Bible does not say that Israel has promised the land from the Euphrates to the Nile. It says it was promised the land from the Euphrates to the river of Egypt, or the brook of Egypt. And the brook of Egypt is, today it's called the Wadi El Arish. It's right here. No question about it. I mean, any good Bible map, I don't know of any Bible map that does not label this as the river of Egypt or Wadi El Arish. What it was the boundary of Egypt. The Nile is not called the River of Egypt. Yes?
How do you spell Wadi El Arish?
This is the modern thing. This is Arabic. A wadi is a stream that runs only when it's raining. El Erish. Wadi El Erish. Now, for instance, now, lest you think that notice, the dispensationalists scoff and say, well, that wouldn't be a respectable boundary. However, there's no question that the that this is the proper identification. For instance, Jenny Selby, let me write this down, in the Popular Critical Bible Encyclopedia, and he's not dealing with eschatology, simply says, it is not denial that the Wadi El Erish, which flows through the northern portion of the Sinai Peninsula, draining itself into the waters and many other wadis that flows into the Mediterranean midway between Lucian and Gaza. Now note this. This, look at Exodus 23:31. Everybody turn to that. Exodus 23:31. Paul Martin, read it.
And I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness to the River Euphrates.
Okay. Now note this. The Sea of the Philistines, they call this kind of dip or bay-like protrusion in the Mediterranean Sea. This is the land of the Philistines, of course. This is the Sea of the Philistines. I will make your borders from what? From the Red Sea to what?
Sea of
the Philistines. Note this. The Nile does not run from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines. Got that? So it's identified in two ways. It's identified as the Brook of Egypt. And it's identified as running from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines. Now the Nile is neither of those. And like I said, you just check a good Bible map, good map. I think our maps, so hopefully we have, it labels this the River of Egypt. This may be a arbitrarily say, no, the River of Egypt is the Nile, and therefore the land promise has not been kept. Well, anyway, I think the scriptures are clear on this. Second element, that is Israel, yes.
Back to verse 31. What did you say now about the description of the...
Read Exodus 23:31.
Okay. And I will set thy bounds from the Red Sea even unto the Sea of the Philistines.
Okay. The Red Sea, the Sea of the Philistines. Elsewhere it's called the Brook of Egypt. Okay. And from what?
And from the desert unto the river.
Okay. What's the river again?
Euphrates.
And the river is the Euphrates River, and from the desert here. The Nile, the desert does not extend to the Nile. And no, every time you're every description is it's from the desert, not from the Nile. The desert here to the Brook of Egypt marked the beginning of the desert. It was the natural boundary of Egypt. That is, that's where the desert began. It's not just to the west of the east of the river valley here, the Delta Valley. And so dispensations ignore the scriptures teach, which clearly outline the boundaries, and simply state that it's the Nile River, and that has not, and Israel has never owned that. They're going to soon. Well, whatever. So that's not the only approach to the question. That is to identify the geography. What does the Bible say about the keeping of that promise? First of all, I point out in the outline that Israel occupied the inheritance. Deuteronomy 1:8. Joshua 24, 28. The end of the 40 years of wandering, Moses, in his farewell of... Yes, Jim.
Did you cover the nature of the question?
Yeah, the nature of the question is, I pointed out that this is one of the key elements in dispensationalism. If the land promise has been kept, it's like losing, well, it really just threatened the whole system. By the way, keep in mind, the modern dispensational fervor for the preservation of modern Israel, the claim that Israel has a right to that land, Jared Falwell and his moral majority say that one of the points they must agree upon is that the right of Israel to exist. Well, depends what you mean. Some people mean the political right, historical right, but he means the theological right. And based upon, fundamentally, upon the fact that Israel was promised that land, and that promise has never been kept. It's absolutely fundamental. Behold, I have set the land, this is Deuteronomy 1:8. Behold, I have set the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swear or promised unto your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give unto them to their seed. So Moses has told the people, after the 40 years wandering, okay, you've been promised this, go get it. Joshua 24:28. After the conquest was accomplished, Joshua says, Joshua, let the people depart, every man unto his inheritance. So Israel occupied the inheritance. Okay. However, as I point out next, the inheritance was, number one, temporary, number two, conditional. Israel was to inherit a land with houses they had not built, wells they had not dug, but this great blessing was accompanied with both warnings and gloomy predictions. Possession of the land depended upon fidelity to God. Now, by the way, you often hear the argument that Israel was promised the land forever. Even if they did inherit it the first time, they lost it. Therefore, the Tamas kind of have it forever. Now, this, by the way, is a piece of ignorance. The term forever is used much in the Old Testament. It's referred to certain various covenants, promises. The Hebrew word which is translated forever in the King James, olam, that's script Hebrew. Yeah, Hebrew students in here. Olam. Olam. It does not mean eternally, without end. It can't possibly mean that. But the fundamental meaning of olam is for a long, indefinite period of time. Sometimes it's in the future, sometimes in the past. It does not mean eternally in the sense of never ending. It's used in regard to circumcision, for instance. We know that ended. For instance, in Genesis 6, it says, talks about the mighty men of old, the mighty men of olam. Well, those men didn't live eternally, just in the long, indefinite. Sometimes it means the long, indefinite past. Sometimes it means the long, indefinite future. But it does not mean without end. Now, there's a case. Remember I said dispensationalism has never really taken hold among real scholars? Well, see, a real scholar, it's very common. The standard fare in dispensational texts is to argue that the land promise, that they were promised the land forever, and therefore forever means forever, and even if Israel did inherit it the first time, they lost it, therefore that is not the fulfillment of the promise, because the promise was that they would have it forever. You got that? This is commonly, almost every dispensational text argues this. You probably read this. It should be forever. So by the way, the Seventh-day Adventists used this same argument for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was given forever. And that's why there's not very many good Seventh-day Adventist scholars recognized in the evangelical world. Well, this argument that either the Sabbath or circumcision or the land promise was forever based on the word olam, no scholar would ever use that. That is basing a doctrine upon the English word forever. But our English word, forever, does not comprehensively translate the word olam. This is common, that's not unusual. Languages seldom translate other languages exactly. It does not mean forever in the sense of without end. So, you get people who use the English. Remember I said that dispensation probably used the English text? Well, here's a case of it. Nobody who knows Hebrew would ever use that argument. You got that? That forever means, therefore, it would have no end. Nobody who knows Hebrew would ever use that argument. Yet, it's the standard argument of no dispensation. This is, are you getting, is the picture beginning to dawn on you? It's one of the reasons. See, you begin to see, well, now, you can see why real scholars just have not bought this idea. This is the kind of thinking, the kind of argument that holds it together. Because olam simply means, as I said, a long indefinite period of time. Sometimes even in the past. That's applied to many things. It's going to be, and you can find many cases where the word, we won't take time to trace it down here, where the word olam is used to indicate things which we know have stopped. But they went on for a long time. Olam is used, well, anyway, I'll just leave it at that. So you cannot argue from the word forever. By the way, the Hebrew does not have a word for eternal. We mean without end. It was, in the Hebrew language, infinitude was described or was stated by analogy. Your children shall be as the sand of the sea, like the stars in the heaven. Get that? He shall go on as long as the stars are there. But so infinitude is indicated by analogy. And but again, there's no exact Hebrew word for eternally, but it's in the sense of without end. And by the way, I would point out that even the dispensationalists do not believe it's without end, because the Lord destroys the world after the millennium, and he's not going to leave Palestine untouched. You know, the whole world's going to be destroyed except for Palestine floating around in space with the Jews on it. Well, it says forever. Well, anyway. Okay, but in the first place, the inheritance was temporary and conditional. Look at Joshua 23:15-16, and I gave you this, I believe. Yes. Let me read it for you. Therefore it shall come to pass that as all good things are come upon you, which the Lord your God promised you, so shall the Lord bring upon you all evil things until he have destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you. When you have transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and have gone and served other gods and bowed yourself to them, then shall the anger of the Lord be kindled against you, and you shall perish quickly from off the good land which he has given you. Not only was it stated that this is conditional, this will be yours as long as, but it's also prophesied that Israel is not going to keep their promise to God. The heathen were not driven out as they were supposed to be. The promises, the conditions were not met by Israel. Judges 2, verses 20 through 23. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he said, because that this people has transgressed my covenant which I commanded their fathers, and have hearkened not to my voice, I also will not henceforth drive out any from before them of the nations which Joshua left when he died, that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the way of the Lord to walk therein as their fathers did keep it or not. Therefore the Lord left those nations without driving them out hastily. It delivered them into the hand of Joshua. The pagan offerings were left standing. Israel lost control of a portion of the land. Now we come to the critical point. The promise, regardless of the geographical boundaries or whatever was involved, we're going to see that the Bible categorically declares the promises fulfilled. These are the important verses here. Joshua 21:43. Everybody turn to that. Joshua 21:43. This one verse, by the way, if you follow it to its logical conclusion, destroys dispensationalism. they would admit that. Logically, it does. Joshua 21:43. Ed, you read it, please. We don't have time. Ron?
So the Lord gave Israel all the land which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they possessed it and lived in.
What does it say? The Lord
gave it to them.
What did he give to them? All that he had promised.
The last verse says not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. All came to pass.
Yeah, the next one I have listed, 145. 21. Thank you.
They need a
buddy. That's okay. We're called Southern. I bet you tell the punchline a joke.
I have a
line
that says
that. Well, I maintain that you have to have a lot of professional help not to get back to the point. The Lord gave Israel all the land which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they possessed it. Not one, as Paul has indicated, of the good promises, verse 45, which the Lord had made the house of Israel fail, all came to pass. But we're not finished yet. Look at Joshua 23:14. This is Joshua's farewell address. Now behold, today I'm going the way of all the earth. I'm going to die. You know in all your hearts, in all your souls, that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. All have been fulfilled for you. Not one of them has failed. Nehemiah 9:7-8. By the way, you might have a score filler, by the way.
I'll bring it.
I've got an office. I like it. There's a ticket time to play for
you. You're in the library, so can we get in the library?
I've got a better score filler, right? It's got to be a filter. Oh, you can't always check down. Usually they go ahead. Usually they discuss it under one set of verses and then make the commentary again in parallel verses. So you can't always find it easily. Nehemiah 9:7-8. Well, I like this. Nehemiah would not have made a good Baptist. Thou art the Lord God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldees, gave him the name Abraham. And thou didst find his heart faithful before thee, and thou didst make a covenant with him to give him the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, the Girgashite. And to give it to his descendants. You're the one who called it. You gave him this land promise, right? And what does it say? And thou hast fulfilled thy promise, for thou art righteous. And then Acts 7 says, yes.
They didn't possess all the land until the time of Solomon's reign.
Oh, yes, they did. They didn't keep it very long. And it was a conditional because the heathen were not driven out, it was not absolute dominion. But regardless of whatever the promise meant, the Bible declares it kept. Not just once, but one more. Acts 7:17. This is, of course, Stephen's famous sermon. But as the time of the promise was approaching, which God had assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt. And he goes on pointing out that... here's mine. Did you go to my office and get it?
It's a nice library, yes. Why did you put the Bible by the final?
Put them all together, don't
they? Yes, I went all the way around the room.
But you're going to the library over here.
They shouldn't have one. She's not here today.
By the way, if this class, like in this kind of, comes across as kind of a polemic against dispensationalism, I would point out that what we're studying here would not be studied at all were it not for dispensationalism. I mean, you would pass over this in a history of Israel course and go right on. It's really not important. It's ancient history. I mean, there's no... Somebody said, why don't you write a book on the subject? What would you write? I mean, the promise is made, the promise is kept. The history of Israel, of course, shows it. You see, it's an artificial issue. So you deal with it negatively or polemically, because otherwise it wouldn't be an issue. Let's see if we can find a footnote here under Joshua 21. Nehemiah 9. See, Joshua 21. I don't get the first choice. Earlier text, usually. I'm not promising anything, because like I say, it's not consistent. Joshua 21. No, I'm not putting up there. It isn't common on those verses, interesting, is it? I wonder why not.
If they're leaving, let me know.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, that's nothing.
Right. Okay, promise was declared fulfilled, and by the way, of course this is really not important, but even after much of it was lost, David recovered it, 2 Samuel 8:3, I just mentioned in passing, and Solomon ruled over it, 1 Kings 4:21 through 25. You can look at 2 Samuel 8:3. It says, David smote also Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. It says in 1 Kings 4:21, and Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river unto the land of the Philistines, unto the border of Egypt. They brought presents and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon ruled over it. However, the promise was already declared fulfilled. And 1 Kings 4:24 through 25, you can look at. He had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from his the boundaries. Judah and Israel dealt safe, every man under his vine and under his fig tree. Dan even the Beersheba all the days of Solomon. Okay, now, so the land promises have been declared fulfilled. Now, Scofield says that the land promises were modified by indications of three dispossessions and repossessions, which is an attempt to kind of get around this, but the Bible, it is very arbitrary and unbiblical, non-hermeneutical to say, well, yes, it says it's been fulfilled. It really hasn't been. Yes, sir.
The land promises, Genesis 15:18.
Yeah.
I had him leaving.
This is the 15 one?
18.
Yeah. Says here, the gift of the land is modified by prophecies of three dispossessions and restoration. Two dispossessions, restorations have been accomplished. Israel is now in the third dispersion, in which he will be restored to the return of the Lord as king under the Davidic covenant. Has been categorically declared fulfilled in several places, and that was never an issue. The idea that God still owed the Jews real estate is an idea brought to the scriptures, so you don't get it from it. Okay? But that promise has been declared, yes. God is praiseworthy. By three dispossessions and repossessions of an intricate system. You've got three or four comings. See, this is a very interesting hermeneutic that says, well, yes, it was fulfilled in what the Bible says, but it's also fulfilled in some other way. Which, of course, blows the door wide open. There's nothing you can't prove from the Bible if you take that approach. The Bible, a prophecy is declared fulfilled. Yes, it is, but not really.